So I think we should have a word of the day.
Body humping legs?
No, I think the word of the day should be brevity.
That's the challenge.
Oh. Hey, I already got more YouTube likes than the last four episodes combined. Or maybe not.
I did get one email from somebody who said how much she enjoyed and appreciated the novel length elevator pitch.
Really?
Oh. Love you, Kiko.
That's awesome. Oh, Kiko.
Hi, I'm Adrian in suburban Chicagoland, and this is Your Parenting Mojo with Jen Lumenlon. Jen is working on a series of episodes based on the challenges you are having with your child. From toothbrushing to sibling fighting to the endless resistance to whatever you ask, Jen will look across all the evidence from thousands of scientific papers across a whole range of topics related to parenting and child development to help you see solutions to the issue you're facing that hadn't seemed possible before. If you'd like a personalized answer to your challenge, just make a video if possible, or an audio clip if not, that's less than 1 minute long that describes what's happening, and email it to support@yourparentingmojo.com. And listen out for your episode soon.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the second part of Ask Alvin Anything. We really appreciate all the listeners and members who took the time to send in their questions through video, audio, and email. I don't think, Jen, we receive questions through smoke signals, so, you know, I covered myself there. And if you haven't already listened to or seen part one of Ask Alvin Anything, we encourage you to check it out first. And I believe we will have a link in the show notes.
Hi, I'm Kareem, and Iris and I will be co-hosting part two of this conversation with Alvin. So if you listened to the last episode, you got to meet us then, but we'll do a quick reintroduction. I'm Kareem, and I'm a mama to a two-year-old, and I live in Portland, Oregon with my family. I found out about Your Parenting Mojo through Courtney Dern, who is from Beach Street Parenting, which is an awesome community we're a part of here in Portland. And I got to chat with Alvin at one of Jen's workshops, and I was really inspired and gleaned some inspiration and great insights. And I am excited to continue that today in this part two. And yeah, just great to be back here with you, Iris, as well.
Yeah, thanks, Kareem. It's been really exciting working with you, like planning, and not just this final thing, but we had some prep work for this. So hanging out with you has been really, really great. And I'm Iris from Vancouver, Canada, and originally from the Philippines. And I am mama to Malaya. She's 9 years old. She's affectionate, smart, and feisty. And I'm also mom to a 7-month-old Labradoodle, who's also affectionate, smart, but not as feisty as Malaya, which is good break.
So,
and I've been following Jen's work for over 5 years and been a member of the Your Parenting Mojo community. And one gift that I received in September is meeting Jen and her family in person as part of Jen's book tour here in Vancouver. So it was a real pleasure for me and my family to hang out with Jen, Karis, and Alvin. And to take us back where we left off, here's Kareem to start off our conversation with. I'm going to describe Alvin as Jen's husband, Karis's father, biker, creative, and business consultant, and an extraordinary artist photographer. So, folks, let's give it up for Alvin. Oh, Alvin in the house.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just thankful that that Iris fed me lumpia when we were in Vancouver. That's all I have to say.
Okay. So, Corinne will take it from here.
Yes. Welcome back, Alvin. It sounds like people liked having you on Your Parenting Mojo. So maybe that's a good sign for the future, episode 300, maybe. So welcome back, listeners, as well. Last time we got to hear some really fun stories about the start of Jen and Alvin's relationship And we want to circle back to the topic of their relationship. There were a few questions we didn't get to because we had so much to talk about last time.
That's not why we didn't get to them.
Hey, it's my first time on the podcast.
Yeah, it was our first time too. So we'll give ourselves some slack that we had to make it a two-part episode. But we want to start with a listener question. This one was emailed in by Sarah S. And Sarah wanted to hear more about Jen's autism self-diagnosis. And that was something Jen shared about in episode 175 of your Parenting Mojo. And so Sarah wrote in via email, "I'm curious how Jen's autism self-diagnosis changed anything about their marital and or family relationships and organization." And I assume organization, maybe you know what that means. I assume that means your Parenting Mojo or your work, you know, maybe your both of your professions.
And more broadly, probably, relationship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure how to answer this question. No, because I don't want to say struggled with this, but we've talked about this at times where we've been good and at times where we've been stressed. And I think a lot of it sort of has to do with, again, to back up, to sort of point to Jen's book, around cultural expectations. You know, I was attracted to Jen and love her for who she is. And that is because of and in spite of her various nuances. And I think probably that could be said about a lot of relationships and how people look at partners potentially, right? Mm-hmm. So there's obviously stuff that initially in the relationship you find very endearing. And then over time you might be like, oh God, that's annoying the heck out of me. But it doesn't change your love for them. So I think autism or being on the spectrum or whatever you call it could potentially make sense of certain things. But I think it also, where I'm confused or conflicted about is like putting a label on it and like sort of grouping it with another subset potentially of the population. Whereas in the past, I've just thought of these nuances as Jen. Now, what's been helpful is, and again, I still trip up on like a label or diagnosis or whatever, on the nuances where we differ, right? So I think what is part of the reframing for me, which I don't know that it changes like someone who is neurodivergent or neuro non-divergent, normal, whatever it's called, is like the idea that, I guess, technically, your brain is wired to think a certain way versus my brain is wired to think maybe a different way. Where I struggle is like, why don't we just think about people generally like that, right? But, you know, like we joked, we have a colleague or a family friend who used to be a professor for decades at MIT. And when she found out, she's like, I knew. Oh, and by the way, everyone at MIT is like autistic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, huge generalization, but like, I think culture has driven us towards like an idea of success, an idea of how we should act, an idea of how we should behave. And that shapes how we look at ourselves, that shapes how we look at our children. And I think putting a lens on it through this learning or discovery, I don't know that it's helped me or made me more confused, because I feel like we should just be looking at each other through the lens of like individuals versus like, again, she's like blushing or laughing. I don't know. She's or like, but I mean, I mean it like, it's like in many ways it's made me, it's been more challenging with that discovery because it sort of tangles things up a little bit. Whereas before it's just like, it's Jen. Mm-hmm. Right now it's like, it's Jen. Is it autism? Does it change how I look at it now versus before? Whereas before it's just Jen, right? And I accepted it or didn't accept, whatever. So, you know, she recommended a book for me to read earlier on and I got partially through it.
He got halfway through it and the library wrote it off as lost because he'd had it for so long.
It was some book about like partnering with, what was it?
I don't remember what it was called, but I can find it and put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, but I read it and like I associated with some of the stuff and I like in reading it, I couldn't help but think how it almost felt like, what are those yellow cheat sheet notes that we...
Cliff notes.
Cliff notes. I don't know. I mean, I'm dating myself.
I'm sure they're online now.
Yeah, I used to buy yellow pamphlets on occasion. I felt it was like a bit of a cliff notes, but it was like anything. It's not plug and play. I think it's to help understand. If there's any takeaway, I think, from learning about it and reading the book, it's the idea that people have their own, I guess, narratives and stories and the way they process things. And maybe folks who are neurodivergent are further along from folks who are deemed non-neurodivergent. But obviously, Jen is like on the spectrum in terms of superpower spectrum versus like hard to function spectrum. But I don't know that it changed much.
Okay, let's pause here because autistic people listening are cringing at the superpower label. I think I can speak to some of that with like three very short anecdotes. When you were reading that book, I remember a conversation when I was standing in the doorway of the bedroom one morning, and it was something to the effect of, "See, I thought I was the crazy one. Turns out you're the crazy one." So I think there was a sense of validation for you that the way you had been perceiving my actions, you know, some of the things I do are not what neurotypical people would do.
That's true.
And that allowed you to then accept some of those things, like when I walk around the house turning the air purifiers off because I can't stand the white noise. And before, you would walk around behind me, turn them all back on again. And then sometimes after that, you would actually be the one who would turn them off yourself. So I agree that labeling is not very helpful. And also that labeling somehow enabled you to accept things that you had previously only seen as annoying, I think, is the second piece. And then the third piece is, it's really given us a way to understand the differences in how each other think in a way that I think we both perceive as positive. So for example, when you do an update to the website and you show it to me, you want me to first say the things that I see that are good about it and then give you any feedback points, where I would just assume we were on the same page, that everything was good, except for the things that I want to change. And whereas he would get all stuck in, well, why don't you see all the good things? I'm like, I do see the good things. I assumed that you knew that because I only said these few things needed changing. And so now we know that about each other, and I can, you know, give the shit sandwich of, you know, all these things are really good and there are some things to change and this stuff is really good. So it helps us to communicate in a way that the other could actually receive. And he now knows that if I forget to do that sometimes, it's not because I don't see the value in the work that he's doing. It's because, you know, I'm just focusing on the few things that need changing. So that's how I perceive.
Yeah, I guess I don't always connect it to autism. Or to being on the spectrum, right? Like I guess that's a huge point probably for you and for learning. And maybe it was a bridge or a gateway to just that general understanding. Jen thinks about certain things very different than I do. And the narrative in my head that I have that she doesn't appreciate things per se, or she's thinking about something a way that I disagree with, is the narrative that's in my own head and not necessarily the narrative that's reality. I think the biggest thing is, it's almost like Jen looks at it like from a fresh perspective of like, what can we be doing and what should we be doing versus what culture says we should be doing or what we can't be doing. And that has a trickle effect on empowering Harris, basically, as well as empowering herself. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether it comes to homeschooling, whether it comes to taking on projects, like right now, they're working on a construction project where we had a set of stairs that was outside, was previously a laundry room to our house. We converted it into a third bedroom before Karis was born. And for the last 9 years, these stairs have been getting decrepit and dilapidated. For the last 2 months, Karis and Jen have been working on demoing the stairs, dismantling the stairs, laying down brick and cement, and then building a fence from scratch using power tools and saws and grinders. So I think the majority population, specifically the majority of moms, probably would not look at the pile of rubble and be like, learning opportunity to help fix something that is problematic, but also to teach our daughter how to use tools. And most importantly, how to show her that what's possible. Because of, I think, how she's wired, her first inclination is not like, a man should do that, or I can't do that, or we should hire someone to do that. Her first inclination is like, I can do that. And part of what I want to pass on to Karis is, you know, showing her how easy it is to do this so that she could take on any task, right? So again, removing those filters and layers of preconceived notions that we have in our own head that that culture has taught us, and just doing it. I think that's the greatest observation in connecting the dots that I've had now, as we've taken on so many things like learning how to go crabbing and fishing and all that, and like different stuff that I share it with friends and they're like, oh my gosh, you live with two badass women. I'm like, yeah, I do. And I didn't do that. I just take pictures of it.
Yeah. Thank you. Like I said, we could ask you more and more about this just because it's always interesting to hear about, you know, people's growth and how they change and learn about themselves and then how their relationships grow. So that, I mean, that's just so fascinating, but we'll move on. And just lastly, topic of your relationship and your family. We wanted to ask how you decided to become parents. And I hear that Jennifer was less interested or not 100% sure about becoming a mother. And Alvin, were you more interested? And what was that conversation like for you two?
You have an hour?
Okay. You're going to really have to try for short form.
All right. So now that I have a little practice, Jen never wanted to have children. And I think that's not a surprise to podcast listeners. I always wanted to have kids. But when we married, I made sure to let her know that I loved her. And as much as I want to have kids, it is not a deal breaker, nor is it required if we were to get married. I've had at the time, so we met in 2004, we got married in 2010. We had a fairly long engagement. She went to grad school, but I basically made sure she knew that that time had enough to know that my life was better with her than it would be without her. So while if we should be lucky to have kids, that would be awesome, but my life is better with her regardless. So I didn't realize at the time that, you know, I was being just truthful, transparent, honest, and there were no expectations that she would change her mind. And I was very sensitive to the fact that I like did not want to do anything to actively try to change her mind. But I think over the course of after us getting married and stuff, she apparently, and she could tell it for herself, didn't want to be the single, as she likes to paint it, she didn't want to be responsible for the single biggest disappointment in my life, is how she framed it in her own narrative, in her own head. That wasn't what I was saying. So here's the hilarious part. So I used to work, or not so hilarious, I used to work in advertising.
Okay, you're missing a bit.
What?
Where I would say, okay, so do you want to have a kid?
Okay,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And you would be like, yeah, let's just get to the end of ski season. And then the end of ski season would come and I would say, okay, so do you want to do this thing? And you'd be like, oh, let's just get to the end of bike season. And ski season and bike season follow each other. And this would keep happening. I'd be like, well, if you don't want this to happen, I don't particularly want it to happen either. And so it's not going to happen. Are you okay with that? And then.
Well, but I think that goes to, again, how our brains are wired, right? As well as our backgrounds, like my safe, stable upbringing. Like, I didn't think I was ever going to be ready. Like, I wasn't studying for an exam and being like, okay, schedule the date. Let's do it. I was just like, bring it on when I bring it on. And of course, if you ask me, you want another piece of cake? Heck yeah, I want another piece of cake. Right? Like, we're getting in like almost 30 days of ski days a year. We're mountain biking every weekend.
Okay, non-secretary.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, who wouldn't want that life, man? I want Forever. A kid, but you right? Yeah, like, right? I haven't gone snowboarding, like, in, like, 9 years in earnest anyways. Yeah. But so I used to work in advertising. I used to go on these big, extravagant shoots and adventures because of advertising. And the last adventure I was on before life changed forever, believe it or not, is I worked for this agency and I worked for... Do you guys know that teriyaki sauce soyve? Anyone? Maybe, maybe not. Anyways, So this small company was acquired by a bigger company. And they tasked us with doing something on a shoestring budget to promote this teriyaki sauce. In short, the team I work with came up with the idea of marinating a chicken breast in the soybean teriyaki sauce, shooting it into space, hooking it in space. And when it came back down to Earth, we would throw a big party, and we called it Okoyo 13.
And it was 2013.
No, was it 2013? Yeah, it was 2013. Yeah, so can you imagine, like, and my job was basically orchestrating the whole thing, including it getting it approved by their legal team and department. Short version. So it was a pretty intense several months. And we threw a party in Nashville, Tennessee, and we did the whole Apoyo 13 event in Nashville, Tennessee, including chicken chaser vehicles and the whole enchilada. In any case, I went off to Nashville. It was a huge success. I had a bite of the sous vide chicken breast, and you know, it was a pretty eventful evening. And I was pretty tired. Got home the next morning after being away for a few days. Jen greets me at the door, and she's got this little...
Actually, you had been whining about your colleagues. And
okay. As I mentioned, it was a very intense several months. Imagine, like, office, like in the office with teams working till 2 a.m.
So he was whining about his colleagues, and I said, I got you a present.
Yes, when I got home. So when I got home after partying in Nashville till 2-3 a.m, taking an 11 o'clock flight where all my colleagues were hungover and celebrating, you know, this chicken space, I get home, open the door, she throws this box in my face. And the first thought was like, oh crap, was I supposed to buy her something from Nashville? I'm sorry. And then I open it and there's this pee stick, pregnancy stick thing. And granted, you got to recognize, we had not had any conversation at all about having a child, like none. Maybe we're talking like generally speaking, but she never gave me the impression that we were going to have a child or try to have a kid. But apparently, as it turns out, as my hungover post-Apoyo 13 self came knocking at my door, presented with this positive birth control stick, right, I learned... Then and there,
pregnancy kit.
Yeah, I learned. First of all, I was like, "What is this?"
And then your second question was, "What do the two pink lines mean?"
I was so confused. Like, this is someone who we met never wanted to have kids. I just hooked a chicken in space with my team, got back, and someone's giving me a present with a pee stick with pink lines on it. I couldn't process. And so what I learned was, like, she was pregnant, and I was totally confused. And then I'm like, I think I was like, how did that happen? Or something.
Yeah, I missed that part too.
Well, no, because she was on birth control or whatever. And she had taken it upon herself to come off birth control and not tell me, thinking she's got like a year to get pregnant. And she gets pregnant right away. And that's how she decides to tell me that we're about to have a kid. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Totally does. And it sounds like it was just meant to be. I love this story because we all have like these funny things that happen and it turns into this big adventure, right?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly did.
Well, I think I was in my boss's office, like the CEO of our ad agency, the next morning, and I'm telling him what happened. He's like, you did what? You do not do anything except for smile and be supportive. You do not ask those questions out loud. What are you thinking, man?
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So to folks out there who are maybe listening to the podcast and not yet, you know, getting an early start, don't do what I did.
Best advice.
Well, that was great. Love that story. Thank you for sharing and just being open about how that came to be and how Caris came to be. So we're going to move on to some questions from Iris. I'm really looking forward to this part of our chat where, again, I think all these questions are getting personal, but I think there'll be some good ones here. So Iris, pass it to you.
Yeah. So Corinne have mentioned we are getting kind of personal here and in a different way personal. So in the first part of the Ask Alvin Anything, Alvin, you shared that you were born and raised in New Jersey by your parents who are Filipinos. And I'm curious, do you identify yourself as a Filipino American, Asian American, or do you just want to say, I'm American, I don't want any modifier with that? So I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's a complex question, I think. So I grew up in a mostly white affluent suburb of New Jersey, outside of New York City, specifically like in like our neighbor. We're sandwiched between really nice neighborhoods, and we were a nice neighborhood ourselves. The directly adjacent neighborhood was like next level affluent. And that's who I went to high school with. Mm-hmm. So we had very normal, you know, quotation marks, affluent families, but we also had like a lot of families who I think people were commuting into New York City from the financial sector and living in these quite affluent mansions. I think right now Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi still live in those towns, and they were living in those towns when I was growing up. But I think, you know, our high school was maybe 600 or so 700 people. And I would say the minority population was probably less than 10 to 15 students total. Oh, okay. Total, not percent, like probably total, like me, my sister, a friend of ours, and then a couple other, you know, another handful of like minority people. So I think growing up, and then obviously my parents were from the Philippines and first generation Filipino. So growing up, while, you know, they were concerned about our safety and assimilating and acclimating to the US, you know, in kindergarten, I took speech therapy classes like right away. And I think it was under trying to help me with better pronunciation and such. But I think what it also did was like it removed some of my accent, likely my Filipino accent. But I did grow up in New Jersey. I grew up having, I don't want to say mostly white friends, but all white friends, with the exception of our barcada or like our family group. And as any kid, you know, you're wanting to fit in. Ironically, I definitely had my own strong-willed sort of personality in mind. But, you know, and I think I was able to elevate above like social cliques per se. So while I did want to fit in, I didn't feel the need to be like with any specific group of kids. And even when I dealt with stuff like racism, like I think I was strong-willed enough to create this narrative in my head to think back at these folks or these experiences being like, what the fuck? Like, what's wrong with you? So it was never like, what's wrong with me? It's like, what the hell is wrong with you? Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly how that came to be, but I'm very thankful for it. But I think with that backdrop, you know, I'm a very sociable, fairly sociable person. And while I'm sort of like, I think I'm an extroverted introvert, mm-hmm. I appreciate alone time and quiet time, but I also get energized being around people and collaborating with people. So I'm a bit of a chameleon. But so again, that said, you know, I grew up in the 80s, born in the 70s, like in the US, that's like the height of like consumerism. Right? That's the height of like J. Crew and The Gap and Abercrombie. Mm-hmm. So all these messages out there, right? I used to cut out Calvin Klein ads and of Christy Turlington and smack them on my wall. And I used to like want to be a fashion photographer. So, and while I grew up, like my parents spoke Filipino like around me and I understood it, I never had a desire to learn it. Nor did we have a close connection or ties to the Philippines. And I think my parents were very tied to like making a success and figuring out how to build community with their friends in the US, that there wasn't like what I regret it now, like in the age that I'm at, I wish I had a stronger tie to my cultural roots. And perhaps that's why I was so happy to see Iris like in Vancouver. And I was also surprised that Iris shares, I think we share a little bit of that, that we are not as connected in our current like environments to those roots. But I've only been to the Philippines once, and that was in 1982. And my own parents weren't very tight with their, like my Lola, my grandma lived with us, but she died fairly early. I was in high school. But my father was not very tight with his own family. So again, I don't have a tight connection. And in my mind, I often thought of myself more as white and wanting to be white than wanting to be Filipino. And, you know, and I was the oldest of, like in our Barkada, our family friends, I was the oldest kid amongst a sea of girls. And I mostly found them annoying growing up, right? When you grow up, because when I got in trouble, it was mostly because of things I did to those girls. Sorry, again, I apologize to them. Or like them not coming along or doing what I'm told, whatever. So I never also saw like Asian women or Filipino girls as necessarily attractive because of this combination of like, I saw them as sisters. I saw them as thorn in my side. I'm being conditioned to like Abercrombie and J. Crew. I'm shopping at J. Crew. So I think in 99, I moved to the Bay Area. And I think, yes, Jen's whispering short version. But my point is like, I moved to Bay Area 99, and for the first time I was surrounded by more diverse like group of people and a higher percentage of Filipinos, Asian Americans, different cultures.
And where did you go and live?
And I lived in the Marina. In probably the whitest, most Disneyland, like cosmetically manicured place in the city. Funny, not funny. But I think it was a little eye-opening and like a little bit of a way to feel more at home without realizing that I had this part of me that was looking for stuff. And I think, ironically, I've inched along the way. Like people would connect with me that I've met who shared, again, our cultural heritage and try to connect with me on that level. And it would just go over my head. Like I would just, like, again, I associated more white than not. So I'd have these conversations and people would be like psyched, or like even with friends who are Black, you know, I'd be sitting across the table with friends who are Black and they'd be trying to relate to me on the discussions and levels on what it's like to be a minority. And they'd be going over my head that I hadn't had some of these experiences. And the weird thing is I'm further along in these discussions and understanding because of my British European partner.
White European partner.
But I think now I have a much greater empathy and understanding for like a larger swath of people.
Yeah. And so we actually have a question here from Amanda, and she asked a question in her email asking Alvin, if as a person from a non-dominant race or culture, how does your perspective on race align and or differ from Jen's? So I don't know, maybe one or two examples if we can.
I think it goes back to like what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
She is definitely, while she might lack the specific experiences with racism that I have encountered, the way that she has empathized with BIPOC communities, what she's tried to do in terms of both your parenting mojo and supporting communities that are actually here with us is leaps and bounds anywhere where, you know, I've either done or considered or thought to do myself. Right. I think that's often with immigrants and often with that population, our needs and concerns, including my parents, right? Their concerns weren't for advocating for Filipino Americans when they moved here in the early 70s. Their needs and concerns were putting food on the table, right? Their house, supporting their kids. They didn't care about social issues. They're concerned about their own needs, right? And just like probably with Black Lives Matter and stuff, that folks are like anyone, regardless of race, are concerned about their needs first. And then when your needs are met, we can start hoping to advocate for others, right? And I think that's been part of Jen's journey. And how it's impacted me is, just like parenting, I'm along for that ride because we're in this together. And what it's illuminated for me is a way of considering and thinking about things and living that I definitely would not have ever considered if it were not for Jen. Mm-hmm. So she holds me to a much higher standard than I hold myself. But my standards keep leveling up because my understanding gets greater and greater. As a human, humanity, I don't think, can empathize with that. It doesn't understand. So the key is to gain understanding. And that can come in all sorts of different ways. Mm-hmm. So that's where my understanding comes daily in conversations we have, because those conversations are happening more actively with Karis, because that's a lot of how she learns, just through discussion and conversation. So not just through the podcast, but like through life. Mm-hmm. So, well, I hope that answers the question, but.
Can you give an example?
Which?
Your standards and how you've shifted over the years.
I mean, I used to work in advertising and I used to not care. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I used to, again, focus on my needs, focus on my career path, focus on being successful. I cared about the environment. I cared about these things that conceptually, again, culture says, if you're a good person, you should, part of the percentage of your brain should be focused on caring about certain things. And then there's certain people who just don't care about that perception and don't care about those things. It doesn't mean we go deep into those things or have a greater understanding of those things. That's a whole different story. And I think that's part of why people who don't care about those things see hypocrisy, right? Because it's like, but I think, again, these are all narratives that are in people's heads. But I think there's a lot, in general, there's a lot more we can be doing and should be doing, including ourselves. Mm-hmm. But again, I think the key thing is we cannot empathize with that we don't understand. And we're getting inundated with so many messages about so many things. And even with the internet, it's so hard to get trustworthy information per se, or like there's so much skepticism now that most people feel lost and most people feel helpless. So it goes back down to their own needs. And as we know, as parents, parenting is so hard itself. And then the focus on needs goes from like trying to meet your own needs, which most people aren't even meeting when they're fully like functioning properly. So then the drain that's like meeting your child's needs. I could see how it's really tough on, I could see how we've gotten to this place.
Alvin, earlier you shared about when you were growing up that you really identified as American without the modifier, and you, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, you were like, oh, I wish you identified yourself as white or wanting to be white. And so I guess my question is, do you have an appreciation of you being a brown person now? Like, you know, like, okay, I'm okay. Like, even if I'm not white, even if I'm not here, I love myself. Or like, has there been a kind of shift in your consciousness?
Yes. I think part of it is, I guess, this sort of realization of, again, trying to see and listen to people in general, right? On the individual level, and also observe things on the macro level. Mm-hmm. So like coming to California and San Francisco, again, people, you can't empathize with what you don't understand. All of a sudden, I had more friends that were Asian American, Filipino, Indian, non-white, meeting more people, meeting more gay people, right? All of a sudden, I'm gaining this better understanding for others and diversity and people that are not the people in that Abercrombie ad, mm-hmm. right? Or that Calvin Klein ad. that probably gave me greater appreciation and empathy for like the non-aspirational stuff that we're inundated with. And I think just the world's, like what happened, I become more in tune with what's happening in the world over time. And it just blows my mind, like, especially with what's like happening now, regardless of where you sit on the fence with stuff in the Middle East and stuff. I was editing photos and working on the website just this week, and I watched the Netflix documentary on World War II. And I'm just sitting there, and they're using real footage, and I'm just like, humanity is just so jacked. Like, there's, I don't know how we solve for it, but like, I'm looking at these stories on both, they're trying to tell both sides, right? Like, just because you're German in Nazi Germany doesn't mean you're like a horrible person. Just like, and there were horrible people on the Allies side who were just killing. Like, it was, I just sat there editing pictures, listening, watching, thinking about what's happening in Israel and Palestine. And I'm just like, I can't help but think of Jen's book again and the work she's doing. People are just bypassing the notion of around basic human needs and the fact that, like, where are these actions coming from on the very basic level? And the fact that as a humanity, we're fighting for the same thing. Needs for safety, needs for shelter, needs for autonomy, right? And we have more in common than we have different. Mm-hmm. And we've supposedly like elevated, because we're a people and not animals, to a higher level of thinking. So I'm hoping that at some point, as a culture, we figure out how to go back to understanding that we're like, it's one earth and like we're human people. Like that's an, you know, that's maybe a idealistic way of thinking about things. On New Year's Day, I posted the lyrics to John Lennon's Beatles song, Imagine. It's like, for the first time, I read those words through the lens of like someone with experience. And I really encourage everyone to look at those words again. And they just really hit me in a different way, like thinking about stuff. And I'm not naive to understand like that there are powers, right? Economic powers, global powers, right? You know, and that the U.S. has benefited largely from the Industrial Revolution and the expense of like other things, but most people don't think about that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. When the rainforests are getting cut down, they don't think about like the needs of people who are starving, people who are needing to provide for their families, people who don't have basic needs that we like take for granted in the U.S., where we're drinking our $8.50 coffees because we have the chance to like pick a, you know, what kind of mocha we want. Mm-hmm. So it's not to say that we shouldn't enjoy things and appreciate all that we have. I think there's got to be a way to do that with understanding that the majority of the world don't have these luxuries. Mm-hmm. And really understanding that while we're like decorating our beautiful homes or picking out what to watch on Netflix, that there are really people on the other side of the world worrying about some real issues and life-altering needs. Mm-hmm. That's where I struggle. And like, for example, on my Instagram, I'm barely, not that I don't have a huge Instagram following, but like I struggle with even saying anything. I feel sort of guilty posting stuff once in a while. Mm-hmm. Now, like if you look at my last few feeds, I don't say anything, I just post. Mm-hmm. It's that sort of holding two things, that great appreciation and love for my family, what we've built and what we have, and the fact that there's a family in Israel, family in Palestine, family in Africa, a family in Ukraine, a family in Russia, that's living a very, very different life from us. And I just got happened to be lucky to be born to where I was at.
Yeah.
So not to be like, so I think there's still a lot of positive, but I think, and we got to keep on the positive, but I think we got to do it without being blind to some of the challenges we have.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Alvin. I'm as immigrant, like I immigrated here to Canada. I was already in my 30s. And so I've always been curious of the experiences of Black, Indigenous, and people of color who were born here in North America. And so it's been interesting, the shared experiences, like even in New Jersey with all those consumerism thing, and the same with me back in the Philippines with those Calvin Klein magazine, like ads and putting them on the wall. I thought like, oh, I thought it was just me and my friends, but but very similar. So, Corinne, I understand that you were also born and raised in the U.S. and your parents are Mexicans and Japanese. And I was just wondering if there are some elements of what Alvin shared that resonate with you as well.
Yes, most of my family immigrated to the U.S. before or around World War II. So my family's been in the U.S. a bit longer. And while I love my cultural roots, I'm sad that I do feel distant sometimes, especially losing the language. I still try to work on those native languages of my family, but a lot of it's been lost, especially my Japanese family was interned and assimilation was really, really important for their survival. So things got lost somewhat quickly, but I love, being able to continue some of our traditions and tap in and learn more about the history. That's really important too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely resonates with me growing up in a more white community. That was the same for me. Not quite as affluent. It was a small town. But yeah, that definitely resonated with me too.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to ask this of you, Alvin. I remember in the first part of the episode, we talked about, you had something that really comes to mind is when you had a advice for other dads. You said something about where us women or moms like jump into this whole parenting and learning about parenting and self-improvement. Well, in your experience, you were like dip your toes and then go back and, so things like that. So what can you say to other dads about, encouraging them to have, become more active in the parenting or maybe think about, I don't even know what you're encouraging them to do, but encouraging them in being more of a participative and active dads and to question what they already learned.
Yeah, I think for some reason, I don't know if this is an overly generalized statement, but I think dads are more programmed to think that through the struggles, that this is just what it's like, right? And that maybe it's because we're meant to, like, everything is taught us culturally to suppress our feelings or to, like, suck it up, that as the noise, as the tension rises, as our kids, get older, because it's funny, right? When you have an infant, you're like, oh, it's going to get better later, right? Mm. I'm sorry, Corinne, if this is going to freak you out. But like you have an infant, you're like, I'm getting no sleep. I'm getting tired. The kid just has needs. And you're like, older, we're going to be good. And then the kid starts walking and you're like, mother junker. And the kid starts talking and you're like, what is going on? And then the kid starts saying no. And you're like, because I told you so. And then you're like, oh God, I just said, because I told you so 10 million times. And like this kid. So it's like, I think guys and me included, we're just like expecting life to like take a nosedive almost. And that often is at the expense of like our partners. And then I think that then our partners don't know what to do with us as partners because we're not holding up our end of the bargain. But in our minds, we're holding up our end of the bargain. It's just a new crappy normal when it comes to like raising a kid. And then if you add on top of that, like her background versus my background, then divide of like things are okay, things aren't okay. And then this chasm develops. So I think generally speaking, if I were to speak with any dad, it's like, number one, take care of your partner. Right? Because it's not all about the kid. And I know that our needs have been stuffed down so much that it's not going to bother us as much as it's going to bother our partner, because the person in this relationship who's meant to feel is really going to feel the next 18 months, 2 years, 4 years, 8 years. We're already trained not to feel. Once we start feeling, on top of like our, when our partners decide like they've had enough of our bullcrap, and then I get permission to feel, that's when like it's exploded for us. And we have these discoveries of like needs and like things aren't necessarily working like the way they should be working. And I think a lot of dads, including me, when that you hit that tipping point from when like a kid is like 18 months to like toddler experiencing tantrums, is that we're not on the same page. We're not parenting as a team. And, you know, we've hunkered down to play video games, to watch movies, whatever it is guys are seen to be doing and trained to do. Whereas our partners are left like doing most of the parenting because society says women are the caregivers. So to be honest, like I probably should have been crucified more in terms of my behavior than I did. And it comes mostly unexpected. So dads out there, if you have a young child under 18 months, I would say continue to like understand it's not all about the kid. It's about your partner. It's about you. It's you guys as a family, because it's easy to go down this trajectory that's all about the kid. And trust me, it will bite you in the ass well before it bites your partner in the ass. Also, I think as they get older again, it's about being more present, like present, not just for the kid, but present for yourself and present for your partner, because it moves by fast, like so fast. And it can be awesome, but it also could, you could just fall into the trap of like, I'm just going to get to the weekend. I'm just going to get to like X. I'm not running anymore. So I'll go on a run next month. I haven't been on my bike forever. I'll go on my bike next summer. Like the trappings of like survival as a parent and like hunkering down to your like comfort place of like individual comfort place, not group comfort place, man cave, right? Or if you're into music, your musical instruments by yourself. I think it's just super easy to do that. So I think part of it again is like, as a dad, be present, like shut down the phone. Like don't be checking work emails all the time. Be the catalyst for conversation as opposed to the reactionary, like, because then, you know, no one likes being caught on their heels, right? And when we're trained to like be like, everything's fine, this is just parenting. And the majority of the parenting and caregiving is on our partners or wives. And then they finally had enough. And then they give it to us. No one likes getting put on your heels. So then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. You never said anything. Save yourself some aggravation.
Not that that's ever happened to Alvin.
Ah.
Yeah.
So, but it's all learning. It's all a process. I think that but the main takeaway is like, we all have needs. We're all chugging along. We're all lucky to have our families. Let's just remind ourselves how lucky we are, right? I think that's the main thing, like to embrace time, right? Not to embrace the romantic vision of like what it is like to have a kid, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if our kid asks us to help them with a toy or to play with them, really think about how that time is fleeting, right? And what's my excuse? Like my excuse is like, I'm reading about my horrible Brooklyn Nets and how they lost.
Yeah.
Again. And I'm like, I'm really choosing to read about my horrible Brooklyn Nets versus my daughter excited to play with me. We all have those moments. It's just a time to like remember what's most important and not be like, okay, look back and be like, I missed out on all these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Those are very good messages. And I think that portion there should be like, there should be a short clip for that so that the wives and the partners can show it to their husbands. See, this is what Alvin suggested.
I think parenting is not like, babysitting is not a job. Like, right? Like one way to think about it is like, when Karis was younger and I would have to look after her, that's not my babysitting job. That's just part of parenting, right? And I think that's the slight pivot that dads need to take, right? Parenting and caregiving is not just like the mom's job. It's not bonus. Mm-hmm. You're not doing the family a favor, right? When you're looking after and playing with your kid so mom can take a nap. That's not bonus points.
It actually reminds me of a conversation I had with a couple that we met in Vancouver, where obviously, you know, we just met them. I didn't have a deep insight into their relationship, but I talked a fair bit with the dad and he seemed like pretty emotionally aware, right? He was in touch with his feelings. He was very participant in the Orange Shirt Day celebration, or not celebration, but, you know, remembrances in Canada. And he would wear a pin on his jacket for missing and murdered Indigenous women. And, you know, that's not something I commonly see among men here, like proud and prominent displays of an understanding for the lives of Indigenous women and the safety of Indigenous women. And so that combined with his emotional awareness, I like point blank asked him, right, where is this coming from? Where does this come from you? Because this is not something I see a lot of men doing. And he looked across the table at his wife and he said, you know, the more I listened to her, the better my life seems to get. And I don't think it's true that women hold all the answers and know exactly the right things to do. But sometimes the things that we are trying to do ourselves can enrich our lives and can enrich our families' lives and the broader population's lives as well. I think back to that family often and the journey that they've taken and where they are now. And obviously, you know, I saw a tiny piece and I'm sure they have many difficult interactions. And but yeah, I really hold that as sort of a touchstone experience. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we are at the end of our questions, but we have 6 quick questions. And Alvin, that's the key word, quick. But this, I think, will be interesting.
The questions are quick or the answers are quick? Okay. What are you aiming for here?
Both.
I have so much to share.
But yeah, this will be a little change up in the format. So just quick, you know, first thing that comes to your mind type of responses. And then we'll close up this episode. So let's jump into these 6 questions. Okay. First one, fill in the blank. Parenting is?
Awesome was my first. So I'll just say awesome. Let's go in my gut.
What is your favorite meal?
Cheeseburgers.
He promised in his wedding vows to eat fewer cheeseburgers. In his wedding vows.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is something that people often get wrong about you?
They underestimate me.
Great answer. Okay. And if you could go on your next vacation anywhere in the world, where would you go?
Hawaii. I can't wait. People.
Because why would you ever want to go anywhere else than somewhere you've already been?
Hawaii is awesome.
Okay. Next one. Number 5. What is something you're looking forward to in 2024?
I am turning big 5-0. So I want a new mountain bike and I want to go to Kauai. So I'm putting it down now. We need to be able to afford these things, which is at this point not trending towards that, but that is the goal. And I'm making a superficial goal. I do not care if it's a superficial goal, but I want a new mountain bike and I want to go to Kauai.
Birthdays in December. We've got time.
Yeah, you got time. Okay. Yeah. End of the year. That's perfect.
I might have to sell some stuff, maybe an organ or two. We'll see if we can make it happen.
Yeah. Okay.
You guys are invited. We'll see you guys in Kauai.
Oh,
we'll throw a big party.
We'd love that. Okay, last question. What is one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Everything. I mean, there isn't one thing. It's everything. Like I don't know where it comes from, but I've often thought about death, not in a very scared way, but in an appreciative way and in a way that makes me thankful for every day. But yeah, I think I needed to do a better job of articulating that thankfulness. with Jen, with the family, with my friends, because it happens here, like all the time. It doesn't always translate to my actions. It doesn't always translate to sharing my appreciation. And ironically, I think that it most happens when I'm laying in bed at night. So I can't I'll be like, thank you. Of course, this surprise, she yells at me when my hair rubs against the pillow because it's too noisy. But yeah, no, I'm thankful for these interactions. I'm thankful for I'm thankful for life, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. I'm thankful for the two of you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for making this happen twice. I'm doing all the legwork, so I didn't have to do it. and for asking great questions yourselves, and for relaying listener questions, and putting so much effort into making these episodes amazing. So thank you, both of you, Iris and Corinne.
Well, for me.
Well, yeah, you too. Yeah. But it was easy for you. Everybody else did all the work.
You're thankful for me in general.
Oh well, yes, of course. But.
So Alvin, you're the first one I'd like to thank for allowing yourself to be authentic and vulnerable in this conversation, and for Jen for giving Corinne and I the opportunity to be guest hosts in her podcast, and Corinne for being such an amazing partner in this little co-hosting gig. And I would also like to give a shout out to all those who sent their questions. And I'm going to read the names, try my best to pronounce them correctly. Amanda Calvaresi, CG Go, Elizabeth Camundia, Judy Cho, Sarah Silvestri. And my daughter here, she loves the limelight, so she's sharing the limelight.
Hi, Malaya.
Hi, Malaya.
Yeah. So why don't you stay here while Corinne finishes the thank yous?
Yeah. Well, we just want to let folks know you can check out Alvin's work at everydayisyourbirthday.com. And also we want to plug Jen's work as well. Hasn't been updated. So the book Parenting Beyond Power is available. I listened to the audiobook version and it was great. As a fellow parent, highly, highly recommend, invite you to check out your Parenting Mojo website for anything else you want to learn about Jen's work. There's a Facebook group and membership groups. And if you have any questions or are struggling on your parenting journey, there are so many wonderful resources through your Parenting Mojo. Iris and I can attest to it. And I know I tell people all the time about your Parenting Mojo because there's so much for each person. And again, thank you to Alvin for sharing with us. And thank you to everyone for listening in and celebrating 200 plus episodes of your Parenting Mojo. Yeah, thank you all. It was great to be with you.
Yeah. Woo-hoo. Thank you.
If you'd like Jen to address the challenge you're having in parenting, just email your one-minute video or audio clip to support@yourparentingmojo.com and listen out for your episode soon.